name's Malik. I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I'm sober by the grace of God. And I love this group. Before I say anything, I want to, just congratulate Primary Purpose on 6 years of saving lives. That's what AA groups do. You save lives. And that's not to be taken for granted. Something beautiful about talk about you, I learn about me. When I talk about me, you learn about you. You know, and there's a magic there that I can't explain. And usually during this time of year, doing a lot of reflection, I was thinking back to what my life was like August 2nd, 2005. You know, I picked up once again. And, you know, right now, I wouldn't want to be in any other place than here in the AA meeting. This moment is perfect because this moment is reality. Earlier today isn't real anymore. Tomorrow isn't real. God willing, it's coming, you know, but it's not real. But right now it's real. Right now, I'm standing right here with an opportunity to be a channel for the God that got me sober. And yeah, there were some things that I did. I had some willingness. I was beat into a state of reasonableness. Alcoholism became the great persuader, and it kind of persuaded me. Kind of standing there like,
you bad.
You don't listen to those people, I'm gonna kill you. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what happened. And my transformation kind of happened real simple and real subtle, was that after being beat down so much, an idea came to me. And I said, I was praying. August 2nd, I was praying, God, you know, please relieve me of the obsession and compulsion to drinking and drug. And as I was praying, I sort of got the weird sense that the help that I was asking for had really already been provided. That I was actually praying for something that I already had. That there was a room full of people. There was a sponsor who was laying the simple kit of spiritual tools at my feet. I had what we call a network, a group of people who called me regularly. They were recovered alcoholics. They understood that I was a little too sick to call them. So they called me. They didn't have the idea that, you know, you gotta want this. If you really want this, you serious about it, you'll call me. You know, that just, and I'm not saying if you think like that, there's anything wrong with that. That's not how they were with me as I was going in and out, in and out. And I can only share my story. You know, and by the way, my story's not up for debate. You know, we can get deep in here and we can go back in history about what Bill really meant and Bob really meant and the first 100. And we could debate that till the cows come home. But how do I debate somebody's experience? What happened to them? And what came to me was the strange feeling that God had already given me what I was praying for. And that I said, so why don't I let, it was two things. Why don't I'm just going to let the help me. Coupled with, and I'm not going to tell the help how to help. In hindsight, that was my surrender. Now, how did I get to that point? I don't know if I was an alcoholic as a child. I just know I had a hard head. My father used to say, you got a hard head, boy. You know, he had big hands, and the outside of his hands were black, but the inside was black, too. I thought that was it. My father had black palms. You know, and they were just rough looking. and they didn't feel too good either. You know, but that didn't stop me. I was the type of kid that, you know, I remember we was, I was in my room, had my friends over, and one of my friends had ColecoVision, and I had Atari 5200. So we were all on the phone trying to decide whose house we was going to go to. So, we kind of decided we was going to come to my house, and we're in my room, and we're playing Atari 5200. And I kept saying, for some reason, I kept saying the word nuts. But I was referring to myself. I was referring to a part of me, and I kept saying it. My father come to the door. Lily, can I talk to you for a second? He's real nice about it. He said, I want you to stop talking like that in this house. You know, we don't talk like that in this house. Stop saying that. I said, okay, Daddy. Went in the room without any thought that the fact that he said not to say it again, I said it. You heard me say it a couple more times. Came to the door. Oh, Malik. Now it was a little more stern. Malik, talk to you. Come out. Now, I told you to stop saying nuts. Okay? If you say it again, wash your mouth out with soap. I said, okay, Daddy, but you know, it's by mistake. You know, I'm sorry. Okay. Went back in the room. Sort of sounds like the jaywalker, right? I didn't quite get to the consequences yet, but you know, here was a threat. Not loss of family, loss of job yet, not any of that, but here was a viable threat from someone who I knew would carry it out. Father was a serious man. He was a union man. He ain't have it easy in these days. They fought for jobs without any thought of what the consequences might be. Said it again. Called me over to the door, walked over, closed the door behind my friends, and he proceeded to wash my mouth out with ivory soap. Now, mind you, that ivory soap stayed in the cracks of my teeth for at least a month. No, I'm not, you know, I'm not trying to gas up the story. I tasted ivory for a long time. Now, do you think that stopped me from saying nuts? No, I said it when he wasn't around. And I continued, that was a pattern in my life. For some reason, with other things in life that I wanted to do, you know, I put my hand on a hot stove. I never did that again. My mother was in the kitchen cooking, and she told me, she said, Malik, stop running around me. And I must have been 3 or 4 years old, and I was running through her legs, and she was trying to cook, and she's talking on the phone, yeah, girl, and this boy, you know, and I'm still running. Malik, stop running around me. I'm boiling tea, and I'm cooking. You're going to get burnt. Sure enough, at the opportune time when she's taking the pot of tea over to pour her tea, I run through, hit the pot of hot scalding water, fall on my head. Oh. That was me. And life went on. Father got sick from cancer. He died slowly from cancer. I became very resentful. I grew up in church, very religious family, very spiritual family. Wonderful people in my family. Wonderful people in my family. People who demonstrated acts of faith. My mother, her life was on the line. She was sick with cancer. She had cancer in her stomach when she was pregnant with me. Her life was on the line, and she made a decision based on faith to still have me. She told the doctors, it's easy to talk about God being in your life. But I had people who, when their lives were on the line, made decisions based on faith. And my birth was a faith birth. Because my mother told the doctors, okay, I understand what you're saying. You're telling me I'm probably going to die, that the baby's already brain dead, and he's not responding to certain tests. But you know what? I don't believe in abortions. I'm having a child. And I believe that everything's going to be okay. So we're going to pray for you guys. You do your part. I'm going to do my part. So here I am 38 years later. Still alive. So stories like that. She told me stories like that. And even other stories of people in my family. So I knew I came from wonderful people. Oh, wow, this God thing really works. But what happened was, so I decided, I prayed my prayer for my father when he was sick with throat cancer. I knew the stories in the Bible. Know the Bible. I grew up preaching. My mother was a pastor. My son, a preacher. But what happened was, my father still died. My father wasn't saved in the 11th hour. Like Moses when he was, you know, leading the Israelites out of Egypt. So all of these stories I heard and y'all, my pastor told me to believe. Well, why didn't something happen for me? So I became very resentful and I took to the streets. I rebelled. I was mad at the world. How could you take my Superman from me? Daddy was everything to me. And now mommy has to work two jobs. So the structure isn't there anymore. I dropped out of football, baseball, basketball. And I became a juvenile delinquent. Around this time of year, I would always be in a group home somewhere. Rikers Island, C-74. Fighting over the phone. Because that's what you do in places like that. You know, you can't just use the phone like, you know, cut, stab, just to call your family. Always had a court case. Around this time of year, I was always suffering the penalty from what would happen over the spring and the summer. I don't know, for some reason, spring and summer in Jamaica, Queens, I just always got in trouble. And that continued. But the camaraderie that I began to feel as I began to drink, alcohol was so wonderful because it took me out of me. I mean, I know they call it spirits, and it does have a spirit. Because I just changed when I drank. Felt better. That little, I know some people in here know what I'm talking about, you know. When you don't have nothing in you, no chiba, no nothing, you're just straight. And that icky feeling comes over you. That's just something just not right with the world. And I would feel that feeling and it would be like right here. Sort of just this emptiness. And I remember I tried to, the feeling came over me one time, and I said, you know what, I'm going to try to locate it. You know? And I was touching myself, because that feeling came over me. And I became so dependent on alcohol, I couldn't go to a movie. It made the movie better. When we was drinking, we went to go see Terminator, we drunk some 40s. Me and the fellas, we went to go see Terminator. It was like, oh man, that movie was good. If I was out with a girl, I thought it made that better. Experience with the woman, I thought alcohol made me a better lover. I even drank to play ball, you know, a couple shots go in. Oh man, I need to drink every time before I play some ball. Yeah. So it became my best friend, you know, it was there for me at times when nobody else was. It understood me when other people didn't. But, you know, I was webbing my own spider web. And life went on like that, and it got to the point where I had to have it. Got to the point where I tried to stop, realized I couldn't stop. And that was scary, and people around me saw that I had a problem. I was in and out of programs. I made a couple of attempts to get sober. Nothing really serious, just to kind of get people off my back. I was never trying to clean up because I wanted to live by these principles. And I came to a meeting when I was about 21, and I saw this, and I looked at it, and I said, you know, well, how complicated could that be? Theoretically, I can absorb information. But the spiritual way of life is not a theory. I have to live it. And AA is a place where first you do it, then you understand it. The understanding comes in the doing. Not in the talking about it. Not in the reading it and saying, I get it. It's amazing. I sit down with sponsees sometimes and they're like, oh, I understand. I'm saying to myself, what do you understand? You didn't even do it yet. I stole from my family. My mother had to sneak me back in the house because I stole my sister's fur in the summer. Went to Farmers Boulevard and sold it for $80 on a Sunday morning. I didn't think she was going to miss it, at least until the winter. I And she was out at a club. She didn't even get in yet. You know, she used to go to this club called Bentley's, you know. She wasn't even in yet. So I figured, take the, you know, it's in the back of her closet. She won't miss it. I called home just to see if everything was all right. $80 was gone like that. Called home. Mother said, Malik, where's Sharon's jacket? Nobody could trust me. I took all the cable boxes out of my mother's house. Sold them for little or nothing. Couldn't watch TV. And I started to get an idea that, you know what, I can't stop. I need help. And I came to AA from a 90-day program that I was in. And this seemed really extreme, the things that y'all were talking about. I didn't want to be seen with old people in diners. I didn't want to go bowling with you guys. I didn't make meetings where I thought people were going to see me at. I made meetings that were like off to the black block, in the back blocks, and I would stand there in the corner and look around for a second, and then I would go to the meeting. I was ashamed coming to AA, but I wasn't ashamed for people to see me stealing from my family, 140 pounds, 50 pounds, destroying my life. And I proceeded to build my empire. I was abstinent about 5 years. I celebrated my second anniversary. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't do any step work. I actually, after the years began to go by, I said, well, maybe you were making too much of this. And I started drinking casually, going out with women and wine. And that went on for a while. That went on for over a year. So I was thinking, you know, and I was just doing it every now and then. This disease is tricky. It mutates. It changes position based on its best form of attack. Always. And in sobriety. And I'll get into that, how it grabs on the spiritual principles and uses that to push people away from you. And I've seen alcoholics wind up alone in recovery. Families don't want nothing to do with them. They're recovered. I've seen myself come in the house and people start to disperse. I come in the house and things start to move because it's like, well, what kind of mood is daddy in? That's after sounding deep at a meeting. That's after quoting pages. By no means am I perfect, and I always fall short. And so I went on some serious runs, and I remembered AA. Something came to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. Remember those meetings. And I started coming back to meetings. And I was that guy who, you know, every 30 days, every 90 days, you would hear me saying I got one day back. And I belonged to a big book home group. I was around some tremendous people that are still in my life. But I just wanted what they were doing to transfer to me without any sacrifice of my own. So there was something that I asked myself on August 2nd, 2005. Malik, have you honestly given AA a fair shake? Can you really say that the program doesn't work? Have you ever actually tried it? Have you actually conceded to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic? That you're powerless and you need new management? Have you really given up and decided? And what was drastic to me was that these people who had what I wanted was telling me that AA was the most important thing in their life. The most important thing in their life was their consciousness, their conscious contact with God. And I knew all along those 6 years that I had to surrender to God, that I wasn't just going to get sober in the meetings, and I love meetings. I really knew in my inner essence, I knew that God wanted me. But I didn't know what type of person I was going to be like. Was I going to be able to still have the fun, the so-called fun that I thought I was having? Was I going to be like the hole in the donut? What was I going to become to give my life to God? It's obvious just the meetings isn't getting me sober because I was a meeting maker. I'm not saying don't make meetings. I called people before I wanted to drink. I was following the suggestions. on a train with this brother who works for NTA, who's in the fellowship. Did his whole shift with him. We went out to breakfast afterwards. When he dropped me off, I didn't go inside. I shared my problems. Problem shared is a problem cut in half. I shared them. But guess what? If you're powerless, the other half has enough power to kill you. I was beyond human aid. I was beyond my aid. I was beyond my sponsor's aid. And as so my surrender was sort of like, you know what? Whatever it takes. I just want to be, you know what? I just want to be an amen. I don't care where life takes me. I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no big eyes. There's no little U's. I don't care where life takes me. I'm an amen. There's no big shots. There's no little shots. As old timers used to say, one shot and we all shot. This old timer said to me on a convention, we're all 12-stepping each other. So I began to get some months together, and my sponsor, who I still didn't ask to be my sponsor, he came over to me, and he was waving his fingers, and if you ever meet him, he's very weird. He's going to listen, oh shucks, he said he was going to go on the website and listen to this. So, I don't know if y'all going to put it on the site, but so he came over to me and he said, are you doing any step work with anybody? Because he was a fisher of men and women. I said, no. He said, well, good. I'm going to call you later and give you your first assignment. And I began to change and I found out that I was going to drink no matter what. That I was powerless, and that meant that I had an allergy. And a physical craving that, you know, the double-edged sword, as I like to call it, that kind of doomed me. I had an obsession, you know, that I was going to pick up. That thought just keeps knocking. The only reason I was picking up was just to get the thought from stopping. In the end. Not necessarily because I wanted to. I just wanted the knocking to stop. And as soon as I made the decision that I was going to get it, before I even put it in me, guess what? The knocking stopped. I'm on my way to ride to go cop. I'm calm as ever. Sort of like an assassin. Instead, I'm going to kill. And I was faced with a choice. Because in no other respects did I really have a choice. And I was faced with a choice. When we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, I could no longer avoid or postpone. Or evade. I had to fearlessly face the proposition that God was either going to be everything or else he was going to be nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was Malik's choice going to be? And upon making that choice, guess what? I realized that I had everything I already needed. Yeah, I'm a businessman, but I don't have to get out here and strive. Like I'm never going to make another. And I made the decision to turn my will and my life over to him. And I'm still don't totally understand what I turned my life over to. I don't. And I hope I continue to set aside everything I think I know about primary purpose, about what I should say up here, about my family, about my life, about how to help new people. I pray that I still will set aside everything I think I know about my sponsor, about the people in my life, how they should be living their life. So that I can have an open mind and a new experience. With all these things, please let me see the truth. Because you know what? I don't always see the truth. And I hardly ever see it on my own. And I have I had a life-changing experience. I did inventory. And inventory is part of the process. It's part of the process of transformation. And there was a format for me to see my thinking. How I thought, my actions, my behaviors, my attitude, my perceptions. And I had resentment with my father, who had been dead almost 25 years. Things like that came out in my inventory. The person who gave life to me, he shouldn't have had me because he was old. He was 60 years old when he made me with my mom. He made me a 60. You know how many fights I got into when he would come into the park and be like, your grandfather's here. Ashamed of my own parents. Everybody I ever met that knew my father said, your father was a great man. Walking around with pages, I had pages of resentments. And what I wrote down was just spiritual symbols of what was going on in the inside. It wasn't so much what was on paper. It's what it represented. It's not so much of what people say. It's what it represents. Because the words that come out of my mouth they just run parallel with the spiritual realm. And there's endless treasures to seek. Endless resource of power and of strength. And I went home and I sat quiet for that hour and I was rocked. I was rocked. I said, oh, wow. It was me the whole time. Man, you gotta be kidding me. It was me. It wasn't anybody else. It wasn't where I grew up. It wasn't the color of my skin. It wasn't who my mother was. It wasn't any of those things. It wasn't what happened to me. It was me. Me, me, me. And I need more help. I want to turn over more of this to you. And I'm humbly asking you to take it. And upon that, you know, because faith without works is dead, and there's no free freedom. This ain't no hustle. This ain't no something for nothing. If you're in here and you're worrying about, are people letting you down? People not saying the right thing to you? It's about sacrifice. You don't think you seem to be getting this? You've been going in and out for who knows how long? 5 years, 10 years, it's nobody else's fault. It's yours. You can blame it on the disease if you want to. It's you. It's not primary purpose fault. Because whatever you think about the group, it ain't the other group fault that you think don't carry the message. I met a lot of good people that don't say much. That don't necessarily know the pages. They just live it. They're just practical people. They just live it. I've sat down and had conversations with people in AA. I never heard them share from the floor once. Talking to them after the meeting was like, wow, that guy is deep. Why you never share? And so I had to go out and try to make right what I did wrong. I'm like, man, if I would have known all of this, I wouldn't have did half the stuff I did. I'm trying to rebuild my life, and I have to give money back. Money I thought I got over on. I gave money back to drug dealers. I did. I seen to do it. I saw him. I had money in my pocket. Year ago, this guy was driving with his girl, his nice car. He beat through us. Yo, what's up? Yo, how you doing? Yo, it's good to see you. Yo, you remember you owe me something, right? I said, oh, wow. Driving in my work vehicle. I said, pull over. Gave him his money. Yo, good to see you, man. I always knew you was going to be all right. Yeah. Yo, is there anything else? Is there anything else? I gave him his money because some of the people that I was around, you know, yeah, if I, you know, I don't make amends, you might not see me. No, I mean, that's just how it was with us. I'm not trying to sound like a tough guy or anything, but, you know, it's just what it was. Now, some very violent people. But forget that, because it wasn't like there was any fear there. I just wanted to be free. So the next time you pull over and decide you want to beep it, and then after that, you wind up asking me for a job. You got any extra work, man? You know, I need to, you know, my PO this and that, if I come work for you. Man, yo, man, take care. I can't do that, man. And so as I began to do that, I was amazed before I was halfway through. And the humility that those steps, especially 4 through 9 kind of brought on humility for me. It kind of just put me right size. Because there's people I did damage to. And I'm going to share this story, you know. I had a, and this is about amends. And amends that I'm still praying on how to make if I ever run across this woman. had a good friend of mine. To me, him, and my other friend, and I don't want to say his name. What happened was tragic. Me, him, and my other friends was like the three amigos. I remember I got out of jail. I was doing a little 4-month stint. And me and him hooked up. And time we was getting high. He had some product that belonged selling for. Out all night getting high. I was working construction at the time. I guess I was so-called chilling, doing the right thing, even though I was using drugs, you know. I convinced him. I said, look, if you use what you got right here, I'll pay you back on Friday when I get paid. Now, this is my boy. And he said, Malik, are you sure? I said, yeah. He said, because guy I'm working with, this guy, you know, like us, man, you know, he'll do you. Even though I don't care, you know, I got the shoddy in the house and all that. He said, but you got to pay. I just don't want the problems. I said, yeah, I'll pay you back, man. Mm-hmm. So get off early on Fridays and cash my check. As I'm coming down Godbrook Boulevard, I'm going to get off and I'm money. He said, yeah, cool, because he's going to be coming for the money about Friday evening. It's all right. Got off early Friday morning. My check. Stopped by. I'd already had some in me. And he asked me, he said, Malik, you got the money? Looked him dead in his eyes, and I said, no. Asked the check yet. Last night, and I wasn't here. My girl said he was looking. I said, okay. When I come back, I went home. I went to sleep. When I woke up, my mother said he called me a couple of times. I said, all right, let me go give him the money. But on the way there, I said, maybe I'll give him half. But I was going to give him the money. Long story short, as I'm riding by on the van before it dropped me off, I saw a black body bag coming out of his house. Oh, cops was in front of his house. Guy came for his money. Guy killed him. And his girlfriend, pregnant, and he named the child after me, my other friend. He named the child Jameek after his two best friends. And I saw her not too long ago as I was driving, and I looked and I was like, I didn't see her with the kid, but I saw her. You know, what do you say to that? And at the funeral, she was looking at me with this cold, cold stare. Because only me and her knew what happened. And she was too afraid of me to tell anybody else what actually happened. So she was, not only did she lose the person she's having a child by that's in her stomach, but she was in prison, couldn't even express what had happened. Because I know he told her, when Malik comes with the money, I can pay this guy back. See, you know, I can't walk around in here all funky like I got it all together. There's a little boy out there that's never going to have his father. So that's why, you know, I continue to take personal inventory. I continue to seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact. So when the time comes, hopefully, he can speak through me and I can make it right. Some kind of way. But how do you make that right? And I know some of you are sitting in here today and you got experiences, something similar. Irreparable harm that was done. You know, this ain't no joke in here. And we can't play with people's lives. This is serious. It's so serious that I continue to help other alcoholics. Why? Because at certain times, other activities are going to fail. There's going to come a time where I'm going to have to get off my selfish ass and do something for somebody else. Because selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. It's the root of my problems. It's Malik. And as a result of having had a spiritual awakening, you know, and the essence of a spiritual awakening is just the consciousness of God. I've had a wonderful 6 and some odd years. My family's just so happy. My daughter's graduating from St. John's this year. Yeah, I had a child when I was too young. Yeah, I know. I know I said I was 38. Y'all like, okay, daughter graduating, all right. Yeah. My kids are beautiful kids. I've become the patriarch of my family. I walked my family through a tough time where we lost my mom. My nephew was tragically hit and killed. I call brother-in-law, other nephew. And I was able, it seems like I've taken on the role where, and my sponsor always says, you know, everybody gets a turn in here. What you going to do when it's your turn? And I don't necessarily mean when it's your turn for something bad to happen. I mean, it's my turn now to be the source of strength. It's Malik's turn to be the lender and not the borrower. It's Malik's turn to say, don't worry about it, you don't have to pay it back. It's Malik's turn to say, I'll be right over. It's Malik's turn to say, yes, I can do it. It's Malik's turn to be the one that people can channel for thy peace. So that where there's hatred, I may bring love. I could bring concern. I could bring happiness. I could bring forgiveness. I could bring joy. I could be a channel of that. But obviously, I can't transmit something I don't have. And that's why it's so important for me to continue my foundation. And I'm going to close with my foundation is the 12 steps. It's my 12-step experience. That's what happened to me. God saved me. Something was done for me that I couldn't do for myself. And it didn't have to be like this. So on a night like this, when I walk in, and I love Primary Purpose. I love this group. You know, I don't take it lightly, the people who set up this meeting. There's some people that don't share much, but they set up the meeting. Some of the people that's so deep, you can't get them to open the door. It's people that make the coffee. I mean, what would it be like if the door was closed? Gotta keep the door open. And we meet regularly so that newcomers may find the fellowship they crave. That's why we meet. I mean, could I stay sober without meetings? Yeah, you know, possibly. Did people get sober without meetings? Yeah. That was at a time where there wasn't many meetings. and I say this to anybody in here, and I try to always share this, that I found what I was looking for. Have we a sufficient substitute? Yes. I found what I was looking for. You can't take drugs and alcohol from me. Don't give me nothing. But yeah, I was given something that I continue to tap into and continue to get more. And it don't run out. I don't get a hangover from it. I can just sit and be. And I'm going to end with a story. This time I was struggling and I was coming out of a meeting out in Rockaway. St. Rose of Elima Church, I think they called the Weed Group. I'm not sure what they still call. It's coming out of there. People I was getting sober around, they kind of taught me about, they did a lot of practices in a prayer and meditation. We would have meditation groups at my sponsor house. They didn't just tell me about the steps. They didn't just give me assignments and tell me to go do it. They actually showed me how to actually work the steps. And even though it's something that I have to do alone, you know, I alone must do this, but I can't do this alone. So there's certain things I have to do on my own. So I'm about to go into cathedral to pray. It's nice and quiet in there. Sometimes when I'm out on my route, I stop by Catholic church, and I'm not Catholic, but I just go in. It's just so quiet in there for some reason, sitting in the pews. I'm going in there, and Brother Rashid, who was very impactful in my life, he was coming out. And we started talking. He said, well, what are you going to do today? I know it's summertime. You know, you have any kids to pick up? And I said, yeah, I'm going to go in there and meditate for a little while. Then we'll go on the beach and read this book. And he said, it was a nice day, man. It was hot. The kids were up there skating and on skateboards and beautiful. Go up on the beach with my chair. And I'm going to sit and read this book. This is a powerful book. And gain a book. He looked at it and said, very deep. And then gave it back to me. Since I'm sick, man, and just get closer to God, he started shaking his head. So what? He said, Malik, I didn't get to the point to sit there out of book. Hey, I can just be. So we don't have to have anybody. Ain't I'm enough.
Yeah. Primary Purpose Group would like to thank Malik for coming down and sharing this. Absolutely wonderful job. Good job.
Wonderful.
And our group has decided to close with the I am responsible statement. I am responsible.
Anywhere you reach out to help. I want the hand of AA to always be there. And for that, I am responsible.
Father.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory.